Com.
You're in the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio. And now, here's Gene Steinberg.
Tonight, Nick Redfern serves a dual purpose on the Paracast. Chris is off on assignment, so we have Nick Redfern, who is our guest co-host and our guest. So in a sense, you're serving double duty. It's a duality, right, Nick?
I guess so.
But I wanted to talk first about last week's episode. I know Nick didn't hear it, and he will shortly. We featured Ruben Yorte, but also Harry Drew, who has been investigating for some years a series of supposed UFO landings and or crashes in Kingman, Arizona. I had a few problems with the way he presented it. He's kind of one of those people who is so filled with information, he has a difficulty organizing the information, no insult intended. I know Chris is impressed with him and his knowledge, and we'll be talking to him at that UFO convention in Northern California, so hopefully we'll get some more information about it. But part of the problem is that maybe the sourcing that Harry was using for Kingman wasn't quite as authentic as it could be. I don't know. In any case, our guest this evening, Nick Redfern, did an article for Mysterious Universe called The Kingman Saucer and a Contactee, in a sense relating the reports of a Kingman UFO event to a very famous UFO contactee of the 1950s. Nick, would you explain?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, the Kingman story, you know, within ufology goes back years. I mean, it actually first surfaced publicly, at least, in 1971, when two young UFO researchers interviewed a guy named Albert Stansel, who later was put under a pseudonym of Fritz Werner by researcher Ray Fowler. You know, the story, publicly at least, goes back now 41 years. That's when it first surfaced, this story of a crashed UFO somewhere near Kingman or in the Kingman area with a small alien body on board, allegedly. And, you know, over the years, various people have come forward and added sort of different bits and pieces to the story, you know, from their own perspectives, etc. And some of them have more validity than others. Some of them have some validity. Some of them have very intriguing validity. Others have no validity at all, you know, and like any controversial UFO case, I guess. But I think that's the one thing that keeps the Kingman story alive is, you know, that it's an old case. It's been public for decades. You know, people still keep coming forward on it. So, you know, we can potentially at least look at the possibility that something happened. But, yeah, one of the sort of weirdest angles to this whole affair was a very little known one. And it deals with an equally controversial case, that of a 1950s contactee named Truman Betheram, who claims sort of like flirty nighttime encounters with this sort of hot space alien woman named Captain Aura Raines of a non-existent planet called Clarion, which is supposedly on the other side of the sun, but of course it isn't. and basically, Betheram, you know, as I said, claimed all these encounters at a place called Mormon Mesa in Nevada. Although a lot of people dismiss his story, it actually has like a lot of aspects to it that are more in line with like a hypnopompic, hypnagogic type experience. I don't think it's coincidental, as I point out, that, you know, this these experiences with this so-called Captain Aura Raines, who was going to take him away to this faraway space world, were happening at the time he was going through bad times with his wife, which ultimately ended in divorce. So I think it was, I don't actually think it was a hoax. I think it was like a fascinating case in sort of psychology that it's someone like a psychiatrist would have a great time evaluating.
Now, but Nick, would you suggest, let me ask you here, Nick, would you suggest then that perhaps Betheram was dreaming about his encounters with Aura Raines?
Well, dreaming not in the sense of a regular dream, but almost, you know, like, I mean, I don't believe he was hoaxing. I don't think it was just he had an occasional dream. I think it was more of he was in such a stressed out state with his divorce coming up and things like that, that he actually found himself sort of retreating subconsciously into this fantasy world that got more and more convoluted and complex as time went on. and, you know, to where he actually began to believe it, and his subconscious filled in the gaps. Possibly, I think, as a way to try and make life easy for him, you know, his subconscious sort of kicked in, you know, kind of in a very different way, but in a similar way, that when somebody sees a car accident, something like that, a very bad one, often they can't remember it afterwards. That's his subconscious protecting you. I think it may have been Bethlehem's way of that help continuing. And again, I don't think it's a coincidence that his wife, number three, after he divorced that one, her name was Elvira Roberts, which is, you know, same initials, Aura Raines, Elvira Roberts. So I think there's like a classic case of, you know, that would, a psychologist who wasn't aware of the case would pick this story to pieces, but from the perspective of finding a fascinating case study. But for all that said, Bethlehem's story, called A Border Flying Saucer, was published in 1954, and he told of meeting Captain Aura Raines and, you know, the rest of the crew, so to speak, on one occasion out of seven or eight, actually very close to Kingman. And contrary to what, you know, a lot of the contactees were saying at the time, that, you know, they were sort of 6 to 7 foot tall, blonde-haired space brother types, Bethlehem's weren't. They were like, they looked like us. They had olive-coloured skin. They were sort of 4 to 5 feet tall, wore these sort of tight-fitting uniforms and skull caps. Now, that is exactly what several of the Kingman witnesses to the crash door reported years later, most prominently Arthur Stansel, who said the body he saw was small, wearing a skull cap with an olive-coloured skin, etc., etc.
Now, let me ask you a question here. Is it possible that Stansel's remembrances of the case or stories about the case were based on what he remembered from reading the book by Truman Bethlehem?
Oh, yeah, that's entirely possible. You know, it could be that one is embroidered upon the other. By Stansel's own admission, because he told the story originally to two young UFO researchers, literally like young teenagers at the time. By his own admittance, he was on like his fifth martini when he started telling the story.
That was an interesting point here, that when he began to tell these stories, each martini would help him to further embellish the details.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing is, when he told the story to Ray Fowler, like 3 years later or 2 years later, he admitted that he was under the influence, you know, of these martinis at the time. And he actually told a very different story to Fowler than he told to these two kids. For example, in the story told to Fowler, the thing that came down at Kingman was like a 25 to 30 foot disc. He told the two kids that it was like a streamlined piece of fuselage, about 12 feet long, which is very different, you know. And it's difficult to sort of reconcile how somebody over the course of 2 years can mistake a 30-foot saucer for a 12-foot to 15-foot piece of fuselage, like an aircraft fuselage. But, you know, if you go back and look at the historical record, that's exactly what he said. In saying all that as well, you know, Stansel wasn't some fantasist. I mean, he had a very strong, good background. You know, he was actually in the Second World War. He, you know, was involved in the Normandy landings. After the war, he had major scientific credentials. He worked with the Air Force. He worked with the Atomic Energy Commission. So, you know, he's not somebody who made up a background or even one that was open to question.
Was anyone able to verify his background, that that's what he was?
Oh, yeah, I've got a file on the reason I wrote the Kingman article and also a lengthier paper for a book that New Page Books put out last year. I've got like a 4-inch thick file on the Kingman play, on the Kingman case. I could, you know, if I wanted to, I could do an entire book about it. And yeah, there's absolutely no doubt who he is, who he was. You know, I've got photographs of his grave, and, you know, which sort of celebrates his life and everything else. And, you know, it's, yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that he was who he claimed to be.
That's now, the interesting thing I worry about, though, the thing I worry about, though, Nick, is I'd like to see what was in those martinis. That each successive martini would bring forth more and more fascinating revelations about what might have happened to Kingman. But if we follow what Harry Drew is saying, it wasn't just one crash or crash landing. It was several. I want to ask you if you know more about that in a moment. We have Nick Redfern. He is, of course, an author and commentator. He's covered 14 events for a number of years, author of many fascinating books, and I'll tell you about some of them very shortly. Chris O'Brien's on assignment with Gene Steinberg and Nick Redfern. You're in
the Paracast. Ho, ho.
Hey neighbors, you've seen all those crazy, wacky products on TV. The perfect tortilla, easy covers, hot booties, furniture fix, petty spin, and more. Where do you find all that stuff? You go to asseenontv.com because this is the one-stop source for all of these TV goods advertised. Find all your favorites as seen on TV. Check them out asseenontv.com. And by the way, save 10%. Here's what you do. Use the code SEEN1, S-E-E-N number 1, SEEN1. Go to asseenontv.com to order. Save 10%. Purchase this summer's hottest As Seen on TV items. Save 10%. Or call 1-866-277-3366. 1-866-277-3366. The code SEEN1 to save 10%.
What's going on with food prices? Have you noticed how your favorite ice cream is now 14 ounces instead of a pint? Round-trip airfares into 9 major cities has increased 44% in just 1 year. Ask your 18 to 25-year-old what it costs to buy some nice, fashionable jeans. $300? And yet not one person in 100 realizes these prices reflect government spending and Federal Reserve Bank dollar printing. Gold in the last 10 years has increased 450%, while the dollar's purchasing power is declining daily. My name is Daniel Larson. I work at Midas Resources. To learn more about how gold and silver can protect your dwindling purchasing power and your IRA accounts, call 1-800-686-2237, extension 134. That's 800-686-2237, extension 134. Daniel Larson, 800-686-2237, extension 134.
What's safer and cheaper than prescription drugs?
Glad you asked. The answer is Renovation Teas. Herbal remedies are much safer and much cheaper than prescription drugs. Taste great, and most importantly, herbal teas are effective and non-addictive. Renovation Tea is especially unique, and here's why. We spent years researching herbs and their beneficial properties. Renovation Teas uses only 100% organic, fair trade herbs. Our teas are blended towards specific ailments and health conditions, such as diabetes, blood pressure, anxiety, libido, detox, and much more. All Renovation Teas are formulated and hand-filled in Arkansas. Take care of yourself naturally, the way Mother Nature intended. Order Renovation Teas at renovationtea.com or call 870-784-3121. That's 870-784-3121. Renovation Teas. Renovate your health one bag at a time.
Healthy soils grow healthy plants. So before you plant your survival garden this year, is your soil healthy? Maximize your crisis garden soil with EM1 from Terraganics. EM1 Organic Soil Conditioner, Fertilizer Amendment, and Compost Accelerant provides healthier gardens and faster, efficient garden composting. EM1 from Terraganics.com quickly improves soil structure by increasing nutrient availability and converting organic matter into soil humus. This improves seed germination and root growth, improves plant quality, size, color, flavor, nutrient value of fruits and vegetables, and improves shelf life. And when rain is not in the forecast, no worries. EM1 improves moisture retention in soils, helping reduce drought stress. Just like you prepare all else, prepare your crisis garden for maximum yields with EM1 from Terraganics.com. Order now at Terraganics.com or call toll-free 866-369-3678. That's 866-369-3678. Terraganics. Life's getting better.
We'd like to hear from you. If you have a comment or question about the Paracast, send it to news@theparacast.com. That's news@theparacast.com. And don't forget to visit our famous Paracast community forums at forum.theparacast.com.
Nick Redfern serving double duty. He is both guest and guest co-host. Chris O'Brien's on assignment preparing to present a lecture at a UFO convention. In any case, we are exploring what might be going on in Kingman, Arizona in 1953. Now, Harry Drew told us when he was on the show last week that there were three events consisting of one landing, a disabled UFO, and two crashes. And I have to point out, as some of our listeners might have realized in listening to last week's show, I was, quite frankly, very confused about the presentation because he had difficulty separating the events and I couldn't follow them very well. So, Nick, we're talking about a single event when we remember this particular guy, this Arthur Stansel. But what about the story about other UFO events in 1953 in Kingman?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know anything specific about any of the crashes. I mean, I can tell you that, you know, Truman Betterham's case, you know, just literally on the fringes of Kingman in the same, roughly the same era, was described as a landing. You know, he described as a landing and supposed to be aliens getting out. Whether that ties in, you know, I don't know. But what I can say, and this, you know, this places a very different angle on it, is that Stansel was attached to the Atomic Energy Commission. He was also involved in the Atomic Energy Commission series of atomic bomb tests that were going on in Nevada at the time, which had the code name of Operation Upshot Knothole. That was the name of the program. And it's a verified, declassified program now. A lot of the files have been made available. One of the interesting things about, you know, this case is that, of course, Nevada borders Arizona. In terms of aviation, you know, the distance from the Nevada testing ground to Kingman isn't that far, really. You know, it's only one state away at the best of times. One of the missions that we know went ahead during this Upshot Knothole program was, it was actually a secret thing at the time. The Air Force reconverted several of its fighter planes so they could load monkeys on board. These monkeys, they're basically drone aircraft. They're radio controlled from the ground. And they were flown through the mushroom clouds to try and determine how pilots could be protected from radiation exposure in the event of like a nuclear attack or a nuclear war. And so they had these chimpanzees, dressed in sort of flight suits, kind of like, you know, when the chimpanzees were sent into space. They had little flight suits, skull caps, and they were sat in the aircraft, go through the mushroom cloud, and they'd bring them back and just monitor them over the next few days and weeks to see, you know, if the protected clothing, they put one in, you know, and the another one they didn't put much on him, and the other one they left him naked, you know, and it was to see if, how they would be affected by exposure. Now, there is a story about one of these aircraft going off course and crashing and being the subject of security and cover-up, etc. Not so much because it was any advanced technology, but simply because if anybody, you know, from the Soviets or whatever got wind of what was going on, they would know that experiments were being done to determine how successfully American troops could survive, you know, a Russian attack. So there was a secrecy angle. Now, when you look at that, if we look at that story, if one of these fighter planes crashed and he had one of these chimpanzees on board in his little flight suit and skull cap, and the aircraft broke up and the body was found inside the fuselage, that would actually go along very well with Arthur Stansel's original story about a small body and a piece of wreckage that was fuselage-shaped and silver, which we know would tie in with an aircraft. The very fact that Stansel was attached to this atomic energy bomb test program, you know, where the chimpanzees were used, is even more intriguing. I have to wonder if the whole thing is a distortion of a very real event in which a semi-classified vehicle crashed and that did have a small body on board and that was subject to official secrecy. Now, again, by Stansel's own admission, he was initially told and wrote in his own diary, I actually have copies of his diary from that entire period. His diary actually says that he was initially told that this was a secret US experimental aircraft that had come down. And he said it was only later that he was told it was a UFO. So, you know, if you look at the initial story, I think it's quite explainable. You know, but the weird thing is, if that is really what happened, you know, it's like, well, did Truman Betterham get wind of what had happened as well and embroider that into his 1954 book? And if he did, how did he do it? You know?
Well, the thing I also wonder about here is how did one event become three?
Well, the only thing I could say is that it's like an aircraft crash. I mean, if, let's just hypothesize that something did come down, land, crash land. You know, it's very seldom that unless a big lumbering plane goes vertically into the ground, you know, you often do find material spread over at different sites. I mean, for example, you know, where I grew up in Britain, you know, in 1988, we had the terrorist attack that blew up a jumbo jet over Scotland and, you know, which came down at a place called Lockerbie, a little town. But wreckage was found all over the place and for months afterwards. You know, so in that sense, depending on the height of the object, the speed, whatever, did it explode in the air? You know, you could conceivably have more than one site. You know, if something broke up that somebody managed to sort of glide part of the vehicle down, you know, that's a possibility.
Basically, therefore, the fact that there are multiple areas where the wreckage was found could create the climate for expecting this to be multiple events rather than a singular event.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, you know, if you've got somebody out in the desert who finds, I mean, let's just hypothesize that it's a UFO and it breaks up in the air. But if two-thirds of it come down in one area, then you have a, you know, part of it gets blasted out and, you know, just sort of comes sprinkling to the ground, and then a body's found somewhere else, you know, and you've got rumors about the military securing one site and another. Kind of like Roswell, really. You know, it's like regardless of what happened at Roswell or didn't, you know, most researchers agree that there were at least sort of several sites of whatever it was. You know, even the Mogul balloon people, you know, sort of forced to agree that it didn't all come down in one place.
Now, the one thing about Kingman, in addition to that, is it doesn't seem to be as widely accepted as Roswell. I know, for example, Kevin Randall doesn't believe in Kingman, and I think largely because of his suspicions about Arthur Stancil and the fact that his story changes with the number of martinis he consumes.
No, you're right. I mean, I think there's two things you can say about Kingman that aren't in its, well, not so much in its favor. One's not, definitely not in its favor, and that's Stancil's change in story. The other thing that is not so much not in its favor, but it's been underreported. One of the things I've found is a lot of researchers actually have stories relative to Kingman of varying credibilities. Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt had one. There was the original one from Ray Fowler that, you know, ultimately surfaced from these two UFO kids. Leonard Stringfield got hold of a number of stories, allegedly of UFO crashes in Arizona in April 53. You know, this is 1 month before Kingman, but it wasn't specified as Kingman. A guy named Bill Uhouse, sort of the guy who claimed to have been employed at Area 51, said he knew about the Kingman story and said there were four alien bodies, not one. So, in other words, it's an interesting story because there are actually, when you dig into it, a lot of leads.
And it's not depending, then, Nick, on one person who may or may not have imbibed too much before he starts to remember these things. Chris O'Brien is on assignment this week over at the UFO Con 2012 in Santa Clara, California. He'll be reporting about that and lots more next week. You're with Gene Steinberg and our guest co-host and guest, Nick Redfern. You're in
Paracast. Ha ha.
America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
If you want to get your website online and you need reliable service, first-class service at the lowest possible price, there's only one place to go. Well, DreamHost has a special promotion with our show where they'll offer you unlimited disk space, unlimited bandwidth, one-click web apps such as WordPress, 24/7 support. You can save over $55. You want to know how? Go to DreamHost.com/radio, DreamHost.com/radio. Magazine provides true reports of the strange and unknown. Keep up with the latest on angels and miracles, psychic phenomena, ghosts, UFOs, life after death, and much, much more. To receive your free issue of Fate Magazine, call now at 1-800-728-2730 or visit their website at www.fatemag.com. That's 1-800-728-2730. What are you waiting for? Your fate awaits.
What's better than Mountain House freeze-dried food? Buckets of Mountain House freeze-dried food. Now the freeze-dried guy introduces convenient, easy-to-store Mountain House survival buckets filled with our top-selling items. Each item is sealed in a Mylar-type pouch, and each pouch is neatly packed in clear buckets so you can easily see the contents inside. These Mountain House survival buckets come with well over a 25-year shelf life and are perfect for emergency preparedness, camping, backpacking, or at-home use. Go to freezedryguy.com, click on freeze-dried foods, and choose our 12-month, 6-month, 3-month, 1-month, or or 7-day Mountain House Survival Bucket with 32 generous servings starting at just $69.95. And all orders to the lower 48 ship free. Call 866-404-3663 or go to freezedryguy.com. That's 866-404-3663 or go to freezedryguy.com. 100% veteran owned. The Freeze Dry Guy.
My name is Gary Johnson. Today I reach out to you, members of all political parties. I reach out to everyone with a vote and an axe to grind. I ask you to join me in trying something that's never been attempted before in America. Let's put our parties and our differences aside one time. Be libertarian with me for one election. Together, we'll stop the spending and end the wars. Together, we'll rebuild our own roads, bridges, schools, and hospitals instead of building theirs half a world away. Together, we'll restore our industrial might and our economy. And if in 4 years we as a people decide we don't like peace, prosperity, and freedom, we can always vote failure back into office again. We the people live free.
Gary Johnson, Libertarian for President.
Paid for by Gary Johnson, 2012.
Since 1974, Evelyn Gibson has helped thousands of people live healthier, happier, and more productive lives. Gibsonshealth.com demonstrates, educates, and inspires customers to replace their healthy erosive lifestyles with a health-enhancing one. Now, Gibsonshealth.com is pleased to offer AIM Ready Beet's Pure Juice Powder. Beet juice has long been known as a blood purifier and builder of red blood cells. The American Heart Association says 1 in 3 adults has high blood pressure and hypertension. Researchers found that a daily glass of beet juice beats high blood pressure. And not only that, just a teaspoon or two a day of Ready Beets powder increased stamina by 16%. Certainly, drinking beet juice daily is a better solution than most meds with their side effects. Order your fresh, convenient form juice powder of this amazing vegetable called Ready Beets from GibsonsHealth.com. To buy at wholesale prices, call 800-388-6844 or go to GibsonsHealth.com. Gibson's Healthful Living. Since 1974, over 30,000 healthier customers.
This is Kurt Zubin, the author of UFO Mysteries, and you're listening to the Paracast.
I'm Nick Redfern, joining us as a guest and guest co-host. Chris O'Brien's on assignment, and we're going to have a wide-ranging discussion about the future of ufology and a few other things, but we wanted to start with some remembrances about the evidence with regard to Kingman, Arizona, whether there were UFO crashes there. And, of course, Harry Drew has done some extensive investigation in recent years. And part of the problem, as we always encounter here, as you know, Nick, when you're trying to put together pieces of something that happened 59 years ago, and you don't really have direct witnesses necessarily alive anymore, and maybe there wasn't a newspaper story about it, it's pretty difficult to put things together.
Well, you're right, and that's why, you know, some of these cases go from being a case of something having happened to essentially a piece of folklore, because there are, you know, a lot of different leads and strands, and inevitably then different theories and ideas develop. You know, I would arguably say that Roswell's already gone into that category, because, you know, with Roswell, even though, you know, there are countless people who've come forward, most of them are now gone. So now it's down to sort of turf war and upholding this theory or that theory, because we're at stalemate, you know, and even the government admits, well, we looked for files and we couldn't find any. You know, it's like, contrary to what people think, the government didn't say, oh, we found files on Mogul that prove it was that. They said, well, we didn't find anything, but that's what we think it is. I think that's where we're at with Kingman. It's, for all intents and purposes, it's 60 years old, you know. For that reason, arguably, there's probably nobody left, you know, other than, you know, if you had a bunch of sort of 20-year-old kids guarding the site of whatever it was, well, they're going to be 80. You know, who's to say that they're still fully functioning in the mind anyway?
Well, I hope I'm fully functioning in the mind at 80, and I certainly look to Jim Moseley at 81 as an example of somebody who is fully functioning, at least in terms of his intellect, so I guess it's possible. But this is not then a cold case, but a frozen case in most respects.
Well, it is in the sense that, you know, how do we take it further? I think if it was sort of like an aircraft with chimpanzees on board, and before people roll their eyes, you know, I've got those files from the National Archives proving that those experiments occurred in May 1953. as a part of the atomic energy program.
And, of course, that's when the crash has occurred at Kingman, supposedly, May 1953.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, for that reason, we are at stalemate. But, I mean, if that angle, we still can be, potentially might be able to take that further. As far as the UFO angle is concerned, you know, I mean, it's like any crash case that we just never get documentation confirming it. You know, we get confirmation of something having happened, but with the crashes, they never go any further. And, you know, I'd be surprised if this one did. You know, it's just, the further it goes on, the more it becomes folkloric. And I don't mean by that the people are lying, but it just becomes a piece of Americana or whatever, you know.
Basically, then, unless Harry Drew can produce a miracle, this may be just another cold case that we can talk about, but maybe never get to the bottom of.
Well, you know, I mean, something may turn up one day. My view on all these crashes is that something probably will turn up if they were anything but a UFO crash. You know, it's like if they were a UFO crash, well, the government's not going to tell us anyway. But if they weren't, but they were some sort of classified program, then I think there actually is one day a chance of something, you know, surfacing into the public domain. I mean, there was a story, you know, just a few months ago about a crash off Scotland or something in the early 60s, you know, which has all the ingredients of Roswell, sort of strange materials, story hidden under a balloon cover. And, you know, it turned out to be sort of classified U.S. balloon-based payload type situation. But again, it, you know, it provoked all these rumors about the military cordoning off the sites, which did happen. But it was, you know, it was finally exposed because it turned out to have a mundane explanation. And I think the less mundane, the less likely of getting the truth. The more mundane, but it's still hidden behind a, you know, a fantastic legend. But the more mundane, the bigger chance of getting the answers, I mean.
And you also have to think, if it was just a secret weapon of some sort, having it thought to be a UFO would actually keep the secret of what it really was.
Well, I mean, it would. But I've never sort of been impressed with the idea of hiding stuff behind a crashed UFO. I can understand how people might believe it was a crashed UFO if from a distance they saw all this wreckage and a small body. But I've never really understood the scenario of hiding it behind a UFO because arguably that attracts more attention. You know, it's like, well, if it was a crashed aircraft at Kingman, we wouldn't be looking at it now if it wasn't for the UFO angle.
So I guess also the point being that if we were experimenting with disc-shaped aircraft back in the early 1950s, okay, it's 2012, who cares anymore?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's kind of like Roswell. That's the one thing about Roswell, you know, that even the Air Force never satisfactorily explained. You know, they said the weather balloon was a cover for a Mogul story, but they sort of conveniently never really addressed the issue of why the Air Force initially said it was a flying disc. You know, if they just first said it was a weather balloon, but we hid it behind, you know, it was a Mogul balloon, but we hid it behind a weather balloon scenario, that would be more plausible. But they've never really explained that angle of why they first said it was a flying disc. You know, why not first say it was a weather balloon if you want to hide another balloon, you know?
Sounds strange, or maybe some incompetence on the part of some public information person. There is, of course, one other crash I can mention very briefly. We've done a couple of shows on it, and that is the so-called Aztec crash. We had Scott and Suzanne Ramsey on the show. They came out with their book after all these years. Then we had Kevin Randall, who refuted everything, saying that the one or two real alleged witnesses were not credible, and that's the beginning and end of it. What's your take?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like, I think there's even less, for me at least, evidence for Aztec than there is, you know, for Kingman. But Aztec is a fascinating story because also, you know, it is sort of perceived by many as being a major, you know, crashed UFO event. And even if it isn't, you know, it's an integral part of ufology. And some people say, well, if it's a hoax or it didn't happen, how could it be a part of ufology? But the fact is, you know, when the whole crashed UFO thing kicked off in the late 40s with Frank Scully, you know, this was a major part of flying saucer history and activity at the time. You know, there was loads of stories flying around about crashed UFOs, many linked to Aztec. Now, one of the more controversial angles came from the late Carl Flock. Me and Carl, a lot of people don't know this, but we actually were going to write a book on Aztec. And it was going to be called Silas the Magnificent because one of the main players in the story, or arguably the main player, was a guy named Silas Newton, who was like, you know, like a cross between a used car salesman and somebody who just milked you for every penny. You know, he had all these sort of fancy fake devices for locating oil, doodlebug type, you know, technologies, that sort of thing.
And, so it sounds like the character that you'd make into a movie.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was the whole point of the book. It was going to be about him, but with the cornerstone would be his involvement in this Aztec scam, if you like. But what was interesting is that Carl, back in 1998, actually had several meetings, face-to-face meetings, with a relative of Silas Newton, who provided, not provided, allowed him to see Newton's journal from 1970 through 1971, which talks about Aztec. And in that journal, Newton talks about how on several occasions he was visited by people who didn't identify, but he talks about them being government or military people, who told him they knew that the whole Aztec story was a scam, but they wanted him to keep telling it. Now, this kind of sounds interesting, because this deals with an aspect of ufology that wasn't really popular or even discussed back then, namely disinformation. And yet Newton was talking about it in his journal in the 70s, and he said that the visit occurred in the early 50s, you know, where the Air Force or whoever it was wanted him to spread a fake story about crashed UFOs. And, of course, Carl speculated, you know, was this just Newton adding another layer to the hoax, or was it a case of an early disinformation program to hide something else, or a psychological warfare operation to scare the Russians into thinking we've got alien technology, you know, so we'll have the UFO researchers spread the story. Regardless, you know, it sounds like an early disinfo op, and that Newton was brought in to help sort of perpetuate it.
You know what? Leonardo DiCaprio should become the person who plays Silas Newton. I think that would be absolutely perfect. Okay,
well,
Chris O'Brien is on assignment, and we have a fun-filled session with Gene Steinberg and Nick Redfern. You're in
the Paracast. Ha ha.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio?
Something more important.
Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
We also have swag. You know, we have all these exclusive Paracast things that you can buy. We've got, like, I guess 60 or so different items. And entails T-shirts, sleeves for notebook computers, iPad cases, mouse pads, the Paracast Jumbo Tote Bag, all sorts of T-shirts and jackets and stuff like that for men and women. We have a Paracast aluminum water bottle. All this stuff, you go to store.theparacast.com, store.theparacast.com. What makes it special is that the items are the best quality, you know, great T-shirts, fabrics, and they have our official logo on them. That's what makes them special, in multiple sizes and colors. We even have stuff for children, stuff for women, stuff for men. We have all sorts of sizes, like small up to X large. A lot of good stuff. That's the swag from the Paracast. You go to store.theparacast.com, stop by, and take a shopping tour.
That's what it sounds like when a burglar kicks in the door of a dark house that looks like no one is home. Don't let your home be the next target. Make it look like someone is home watching television with fake TV. Fake TV is a small electronic device that makes the same light as a real television. So from outside, it looks like someone is home watching TV. Fake TV plugs in just like a lamp on a timer, but is far more convincing to burglars. Fake TV deters burglars, costs far less than an alarm, and is highly recommended by numerous police departments. Use it anytime you're away from home. To order your fake TV for only $34.95, go to faketv.com or call 1-877-5-FAKE-TV. Each additional fake TV is only $29.95. So get one for you and one for a loved one for safety, security, and peace of mind for both of you. Call 877-5-FAKE-TV or go to faketv.com. FakeTV.com, the burglar deterrent.
Radio advertising on GCN, the Genesis Communications Network, is simple, affordable, and reaches millions. How do we do it? Let's break it down. First, the simple part. You tell us about your business. Then our expert radio copywriters write your copy. We hire professional voice talent.
Hello there. I'm a professional announcer.
And then produce your ad with just the right music and feel. Voila. Simple. How affordable? 60-second ads on GCN are the most affordable national radio advertising rates, period. And that brings us to reach. Millions of people listen to GCN radio programs on over 700 AM and FM and XM stations and streaming audio live. That's it. A one-stop shop. Creative radio ads. Very affordable rates. Millions of potential customers and customer service that can't be beat. See our current list of satisfied advertisers at GCNlive.com. Then shoot us an email. advertise@GCNlive.com.
Hello?
Congratulations.
For what?
For losing all that weight. How'd you do it so fast?
ASAP.
ASAP what? What's that mean?
Are you ready to get as skinny as possible, as soon as possible, as simple as possible, and as sexy as possible?
I'm listening.
Then get with the ASAP program. It's real and it works. No smooth talk, no slick advertising, and no exaggerated claims of success.
I've got to know more.
Welcome to ASAP. As slim as possible. Whether you have 10, 20, or 50 pounds to lose, ASAP is your weight loss answer. ASAP targets the abnormal fat reserves and makes them available to be burned as fuel and contains no caffeine or hormones. Order ASAP at wholesale prices or join the team to share the business with others. Visit GCNteam.com or call 877-878-4203. GCNteam.com or call 877-878-4203. Lose weight and look great with ASAP, as slim as possible.
I hope that you do listen to the Paracast because you will learn a great deal about the paranormal.
He does it. Well, he's one of the best who does the Paracast, other than Chris, of course, and Bryce Zabel and a few others who've tried. You know, maybe we should have a Paracast bake-off where everyone who says the Paracast tries, and then we have a contest and our listeners decide who does it best. I know I want to be neutral because I like them all. You know, Chris is my good buddy, and Nick's my friend, and Bryce Zabel and all these other people who've done it. I don't want to say. We were focusing here on the early legends of UFO crashes, certainly in Kingman, Arizona, which maybe or maybe not deserves further investigation. Let's see what Harry Drew comes up with. And by the way, Chris is going to be talking to Harry in person at this UFO convention in Northern California, which is taking place probably by the time you hear the show, so we're not going to really mention it.
Okay.
And the key being, however, is that maybe Chris will get some more information that we can go on. You know, okay. We have somebody here as a dedicated historian who wants to try to find out what's going on. Nick Redfern, let's discuss a couple of other subjects here. And one is, you have a blog called Nick Redfern's World of Whatever. And you have some advice for ufologists. Before we go to the future of ufology, I want to go to this 10 best or worst list that you did. Ufologists do not do these things. Okay, so if you want to investigate UFOs, this is what you don't do. You can take it seriously or not. I'm going to read the 10 best list. And should I read from the bottom up or does it matter?
Oh, well, they're in no particular order. I just put them as I felt like doing them. So.
Advice to ufologists in no particular order. Nick Redfern recommending the things you should not do if you want to be a UFO investigator. I'm going to listen because I don't do these things. You know, I don't claim to know anything. I'm just a talk show host. That way I can get away with saying anything. And people say, well, he's just an entertainer. Who cares? Nick Redfern. Number one, the mysterious middle initial. What are we talking about?
Well, you know, that sort of deals for me with like the pompous side of things, of ufology, where, you know, it's like me, my middle name's David. You know, it's kind of like if I was to write a book where instead of putting Nick Redfern, it suddenly becomes Nicholas D. Redfern. Kind of find all that a bit funny, where somebody who's used a particular way of using the name for years, they have a book out and suddenly, you know, it becomes all formal and official. Like, that's going to make any difference whatsoever to the credibility or not of what they're writing about, because they put the first name, you know, at full length and insert a middle initial, you know.
And the interesting thing here, the other effect I should mention, Nick, is that with the middle initial, you do it without the period. Okay? That adds a special, I don't know, prestige to it or something mysterious. The middle initial does have period. But you know, some people who have middle initials
look like Nick Dreadfern.
some people have actually names with middle initials that don't mean anything, like Forrest J. Ackerman, the famous sci-fi personality and author.
Yeah,
and
if somebody's always used it, that's fine.
Yeah, Forrest J. Ackerman. Yeah, the J didn't stand for anything. Harry S. Truman. You know, Harry S. Truman, the S in Harry S. Truman, the late president of the United States, didn't mean anything. It was a letter S.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, because it rolls off the tongue and people, you know, probably remember it, which, you know, I understand that. But for me, I still find, you know, kind of amusing that people do it thinking, oh, I've got to book it, so I've got to do that. Do you know what I mean? It's like it's like almost subconsciously required that you've got to put your name in full, and you've got to, if you've got a middle name, you've got to use it.
Okay. Or what you can do, instead of saying Nicholas David Redfern, N. David Redfern.
Well, that's even more ridiculous.
Isn't it? I don't have a middle name. They didn't give me one. They gave my brother Wally a middle name, Wallace Herbert Steinberg. But when they came out with Gene, no middle name. Oh, well, I feel slighted. Number two, letters after the name. Letters after the name. Like, for example, I could say Gene Steinberg BLT. That's, by the way, for bacon, lettuce, tomato. Forget it.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, it's like if you've got letters after your name in this discipline or that discipline, that's fine if the thing you're working on and investigating is relative to that particular area. But the whole point about the UFO mystery is UFO still stands for unidentified flying object, you know, and it's the U we really have to focus on, unidentified. So, in other words, if you have a background in, let's say we say, advanced propulsion systems, right? So let's say chemical rockets, you know, the early years of rocketry. Let's say you have a background in, you know, chemical rockets, and whatever your letters are after your name, your accredited credentials in that field, you use them when you're talking about, you know, your research. Well, that's fine if UFOs are powered, you know, by chemical rockets. But if they're not, it has no relevance whatsoever and doesn't help your case. So that's my point. When we're dealing with a phenomenon that's definitively unknown, any sort of background or discipline is irrelevant. You know, it's kind of like if your background is in astronomy, what good is it if the phenomenon's interdimensional? You know, if you're a professor of astronomy and the phenomenon has nothing to do with outer space, but you're talking more about John Keel's window areas and portals where these things come through, why is it relevant? Well, the answer is it isn't. So letters are fine when you're working in an identified realm and those letters are relevant to it. But when they're not, why even mention it, you know?
Number three, the ufological dress code. Now, I assume this is not wearing a black suit with special black sunglasses, right?
Yeah. Well, again, you know, I mean, it doesn't hurt. You know, I don't care what people wear when they're on a, you know, on a lecture circuit or doing TV or whatever. It doesn't bother me in the slightest as long as they're being true to themselves. That's one of the things, you know. It's this case where people on the lecture circuit or on TV, they feel they've got to sort of live up to this image or that image. Do you know what I mean? It's like, why?
It's showbiz, baby. It's showbiz.
Well, even if it is, you can still be yourself, you know. I mean, I've seen conferences where it's less about the data and more about the presentation and pauses in the right place to get an applause, the crisp suit, the nice white shirt, the freshly ironed tie, polished shoes, which is fine if that's who you are. But, you know, don't stand in the front of the mirror for 3 hours preparing a speech like you're running for president. You know,
I'll tell you what, I think there are a few UFO researchers who do this. I won't name them.
It's not going to make any difference because, for one reason, you're talking about UFOs. You're not talking about balancing the budget or reducing crime or whatever. You're talking about aliens and UFOs and flying saucers. So, in other words, whatever you wear matters not one bit, because it's the data that matters. And, of course, most people don't care and think it's all nonsense. So however many rows of neckties you've got, it matters not one little bit.
Okay. Number four, saying the right thing to the allegedly influential people. Tell me more.
Oh, yeah. Kissing the ufological ass, basically. Yeah, I mean, I you know, I do a lot of conferences, and I unfortunately, I see that a lot. Not where, you know, where I can tie, you know, the entire UFO research community, and it's not even anywhere near, I would say, 10%. It's a very small percentage. But when it happens, you know, it's just embarrassing that, you know, I've been to conferences where I know what one or two of the speakers vehemently disagree with some of the views of the conference organizer, but they won't bring that up in the lectures. You know, I actually know a couple of people who specifically left a certain part out, which was basically commenting on one controversial case that they thought was complete nonsense and the host was actually a champion of, and they omitted it from their lecture, you know, which to me is like disgraceful.
It's being politically correct or incorrect.
Well, yeah, it is, but you shouldn't be, if you're being politically correct by sanitizing your lecture, well, then you're an idiot. And being politically incorrect, well, I don't actually think it is that. I think it's just saying what you think, you know, and if somebody happens to disagree, well, big deal, it's not the end of the world. That's what we're here to investigate and research, not uphold somebody else's view because you want to be invited back next year and get your $300 fee or whatever.
It's not worth the $300. Now, I'm not going to ask you to use a certain word in number five because of the obvious reasons of commercial radio, but creating an image of don't talk to me, I'm a famous ufologist, which is kind of like don't talk to me, I'm a star.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's something I see surprisingly often behind the scenes at UFO conferences. You know, I mean, you know, I like to go to conferences and sit in the audience, you know, and, you know, just because you're a UFO author, it doesn't mean you don't want to hear the other lectures or meet a ufologist you've never met before. You know what I mean? It's cool to do that. And I like to take books along and get them signed like anybody else.
You want to be a member of the audience. You want to be a normal person. You want to be a mensch. You don't want to be somebody who comes across with a star attitude,
well,
or maybe you have an entourage that follows you and listens and hangs on your every word.
By the way,
we hang on every word from Nick Redfern because he's cool. And we're talking about, and this is five so far, the things ufologists should not do. Ufologists do not do these things. Chris O'Brien's on assignment. I'm Gene Steinberg, and we have our guest co-host, Nick Redfern. You're in
the Paracast. Ha, 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 ha.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN. Great talk radio starts here.
Hi, this is Ted Anderson. If you'd like to listen to GCN programs on the go, I have great news. GCN has created a Droid and iPhone application, and it's free. Just as easy as going to GCNlive.com, click on the banner, and download. Before you know it, you'll be listening to your favorite hard-hitting GCN shows, live or on demand, right on your Droid or iPhone, 24/7 and on the go. So download the Droid and iPhone app free by clicking on the banner at GCNlive.com. Thanks again for listening to GCNlive.com. Again, that's GCNlive.com.
Hi, this is Ted Anderson. Have you ever wondered why banks, stockbrokers, investment advisors won't talk about gold IRAs? They've been available since 1986, yet the financial industry won't recognize the value of gold for your retirement. Gold has outperformed paper investments, yet no word about IRAs. If you would like to have gold for your retirement, call 800-686-2237. Don't get left behind by rising inflation and low returns. Call 800-686-2237. Secure your future and call 1-800-686-2237.
Digestive health is the key to wellness and elimination of toxins. That bears repeating. Digestive health is the key to wellness and elimination of toxins. And Pro-EM-1 Daily Probiotic Cleanse is the key to digestive health. Pro-EM-1 is a powerful liquid probiotic, strong enough to cleanse, gentle enough to use every day. Pro-EM-1 is dairy, wheat, and soy-free, contains all natural and certified organic ingredients, contains no preservatives or animal products, supports a healthy digestive and immune system, supports weight loss, improves absorption of food nutrients, aids in controlling yeast infections, is never freeze-dried, and uses three groups of live, viable, beneficial microbes to cleanse and remove toxins. Order Pro-EM-1 Daily Probiotic Cleanse at Terraganics.com, spelled TerraGanix.com, Terraganics.com. Or call toll-free 866-369-3678. That's 866-369-3678. Pro-EM-1, the raw probiotic.